Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, you drive a car, right?
I do.
Yeah, you drive one here today?
I did.
I drove one as well. Did you cut anybody off?
Oh, yeah, I did. All over the place.
Yeah?
Honking, throwing up that middle finger.
Yeah.
Just generally creating mayhem where I could.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you got to do. I only ran two people off the road this morning.
Oh, weak sauce.
Yeah, I know. I'm limiting myself, saving my energy for the podcast, you know.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. But yeah, of course, we're talking about road rage today and really other indignities of the road.
Yeah, and there are no shortage of them. All kidding aside, I mean, any given drive to work or to visit family, to run an errand, you know, we all encounter aggressive drivers. We encounter people who are maybe paying a little less attention to what's going on around them. There are no shortage of annoyances out there on America's roads.
Yeah, and the other aspect of that is that cars give this kind of autonomy, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before. Sometimes it makes it seem as though just because we're encased in this metal box, we're invisible to others, i.e. we see a lot of picking of the noses.
Yes, I saw that this morning.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Vaping, right? I've seen that a couple of times. Hey, I can see you with your vaporizer there.
Well, I mean, that could be legal vaping materials,
perhaps,
or not. But I have not seen that myself.
Well, I wanted to throw out this statistic from John Susanis, writing for Ward's Auto. He said that the number of vehicles in operation worldwide surpassed the 1 billion unit mark in 2010 for the first time ever. We also know that the volume of vehicles has increased by 35% since 1987, and yet the actual networks, road networks to support those cars has increased by only 1%. So more people on the roads, more cars. What could go wrong?
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong with a scenario with nice, level-headed people driving their gigantic killing machines down the highway en masse?
Well, a little something called road rage. It just happens to be one of the responses in a group of outbursts known as intermittent explosive disorder, which almost sounds like device, right?
Yeah.
And it's very similar to that because with this kind of disorder, you have repeated episodes of impulsive, aggressive, violent behavior or angry verbal outbursts, in which you react really grossly out of proportion to the situation at hand. So it's not just road rage. You have examples of domestic abuse, throwing or breaking objects, essentially the sort of adult temper tantrum, but more in a disorder fashion, meaning there's some really very real conditions at play here when the person is engaging in this behavior. And according to Randy and Lori Sansone, in their article, Road Rage, What's Driving It?, which was published in the 2010 July edition of the Journal of Psychiatry, quote, road rage may be described as a constellation of thoughts, emotions, and behaviors that occur in response to a perceived unjustified provocation while driving. And road rage may also be defined as those driving behaviors that endanger or potentially endanger others and are accompanied by intentional acts of aggression toward others, negative emotions while driving, and risk-taking. So road rage is one of those things that's been out there in the media for a long time, and not everybody has this very clear-cut definition about what it is, but I thought the Sansones did a great job of defining it in that context.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easy to sort of, as you're driving and dealing with difficult drivers, it's easy to just sort of throw road rage out there as an accusation against any perceived slight. I think I've thought in terms of road rage when someone has just been clearly driving angrily. But that's a rather different thing than, say, the time a guy got out of his truck in a standstill and, like, walked up to my windshield and was gesturing at me like he wanted me to get out of the car and fight him or something, you know?
Did you?
No, but the interesting thing was, like,
I'm just kidding. Like, what? You didn't?
Of course,
you didn't.
I fought.
Hulk out?
Yeah, we got out our sabers and went out. No, it was like a really crazy situation because he like stands in front of my windshield and I look up and of course I'm just like wide eyed and appalled, I guess. And like that kind of took, like that took him down. Like that just, the anger sort of washed out of his face and he walked back to his giant truck.
There you go.
Yeah.
Little advice, inadvertent advice from you.
Yeah. Don't fight the road rager. If at all possible.
So road rage, yes, you're right, has become a catch-all term, and we'll talk more specifically about that. But when we talk about this idea of road rage, or maybe road aggression is the better term, what are the conditions that are set forth?
Well, obviously, there's plenty of stuff out there on the road to ignite you, right? You have old people that are driving too slow, young people driving too fast. You've got cops lurking like sharks to prey upon our school of metal fish as we go down the highway. That's what I always feel like. I feel like I'm an animal in a herd or a school, a fish in a school of fish.
Yeah, shooting fish in a barrel, right?
Yeah, there's safety in the herd, but that shark is going to eat some of us. I just know it is. Then you got sudden stops and stalls due to traffic, wreck, death, rubbernecking, pets, wild animals running across the road, the weather, solar issues, the sun shining in your eyes, goes on and on. But the classic example, the big one, right, is the cutoff. Somebody cuts you off or you cut off somebody else, and then it's like in a direct affront to some people, right? You have invaded my space. You're trying to take me down a notch in society. People get super mad about this. This is one of the scenarios more than any that seems to result in violence.
Well, especially the cutting off. Like, that's the number one infraction that people have a problem with. The honking, yeah, we can all sort of deal with that. But if someone actually cuts you off, then they're getting into your personal space, and that's risky behavior. Right?
Yeah.
They're involving you in a potential accident.
So what happens in the brain when this happens? When an individual does become enraged after being cut off? Well, first of all, stress hormone cortisol rushes through your bloodstream, upping your blood pressure, okay? Next, adrenaline kicks in to heighten your aggression, while the feel-good serotonin drops and dopamine increases. So your emotional intelligence decreases and your body is now posed for flight or fight. But of course, you're in this metal vehicle, you're locked away, this individual just pulled in front of you. Flying away, fleeing is not really an option. So your body ends up going into war mode, right? And on top of that, we may be actually hardwired as humans to act more aggressively in crowds, which translates to that metal herd that we find ourselves locked inside of. Now, again, this isn't everybody. Not everybody's having this response to being cut off or any other infraction out there on the road. But it may lead you to ask, who's actually perpetrating all of this? According to a 2010 study, Road Rage, What's Driving It?, published in the journal Psychiatry, we're mostly looking at young males as the primary perpetrators here. But there are a number of additional variables that play into all of this, okay? First of all, they're environmental, non-psychological factors. So you have to ask questions about your potential road rager. Are they driving an excessive number of miles per day? You know, is it their job to drive across country all the time? Are they driving busy roads? Are they driving crowded roads? Are they packing a firearm? Do they feel anonymous in their vehicle and therefore cut off from any kind of judgment or perceptions about what they're doing? Is there aggressive environmental stimuli in the form of billboards or other signage? That's another factor that was mentioned here. And I can't help but think that music falls into this area as well.
Right.
Which, of course, we're talking about Flight of the Valkyries, right?
The most dangerous song in the world,
yeah,
just according to science.
Yeah, it just gets you revved up. You start thinking about flying Valkyries and your love for Wagner. Just another bit of environmental stimuli that can sort of tip the scales, right? On top of that, you also have psychological factors that contribute to a general tendency to displace anger and blame others. They also factored in unrewarding or stressful employment situations, as well as just the overall stress of modern urban living. And then finally, you have bona fide psychiatric disorders to consider here, especially alcohol and drug addiction, anxiety, depression, and antisocial personality disorder.
Okay. So the statistical reality of this is very different from what the perception, I think, is. So let's delve into that a little bit. Again, this is from Sansone's study, Road Rage, What's Driving It? According to the findings of a Canadian telephone survey of more than 1,300 people, 31.7% reported shouting or cursing at another driver, and 2.1% reported threatening to hurt someone or damage a vehicle. Now, again, two very different reactions.
Right.
One is an implied threat and one is an actual threat. And then in another Canadian study of more than 2,500 adults, the 12-month prevalence rate for admittedly shouting at another driver was 32%, and then threatening another driver was 1.7%, and attempting to damage or actually damage someone's vehicle was 1.0%. So again, you're seeing some of these statistics begin to line up. And what I'm talking about here is the actual road rage behavior is hovering about 2%. Another study that the Simpsons looked at was of 2,500 adults, and they found that about one-third of community drivers engaged in aggressive behavior toward another driver while on the road, but far fewer, again, we're talking about less than or at 2%, actually reported serious threatening behavior or damage to another person or vehicle. So what does this data tell us? It tells us that what most of us experience on the road is really road aggression or road anger. It's not true road rage where actual violence is involved, which again is hovering more at just about 2% of the cases. And so this sort of boils down to semantics and this whole idea that we introduced earlier that it could be a catch-all phrase. So if someone's flicking you off, that's not road rage, but it could be characterized as such by someone to whom the middle finger was thrown at, right?
Yes, and it could also easily set somebody off to say, get out of their vehicle and stand by your car and challenge you to a fight.
For the other person who actually is about to have an intermittent explosive moment there. So the reason I bring this up, the statistics or the reality of it, is because you would think, anybody who was living in the 90s would think that road rage was happening all of the time, because this is what we saw in the media.
Yeah, it was quite the media sensation. It was the new new just wonderful scare tactic headline, right? Because of course, aggressive driving predates automobiles. Even Britain's first speedway laws were enacted in the early 19th century. In fact, to stop horse-drawn carriages from quote furious driving. You can be furious with just about anything, and give humans credit, right? But the phrase itself, road rage, was actually coined in the late 1980s by newscasters at KTLA in Los Angeles following a series of very real freeway shootings. But it was 1994 before road rage really picked up steam as a headline-stealing scare story. And it has, I mean, it has all the elements, right? Because it's this idea, you're out there, you're packed in with all these strangers, and then somebody snaps, right? Or somebody just has this explosion of anger with violent consequences.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this is that you can go through Google Analytics and you can do a search for road rage over the past 20 years, or, you know, past 15 years, and get a good sense of how that curve on the graph going up really corresponds well to the mid-90s when it was reaching its apex, right?
Right.
Being reported. And then you kind of see now where it's not as much of a concern, and yet the idea of road rage, that it's pervasive, is still in our minds.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost a viral consistency to it. And people were on the media talking about, oh, well, what's causing it? Some people were saying, oh, it's political correctness that's causing these explosions on the roadways, or it's Hollywood car chases, or it's Mad Max 2, the Road Warrior, specifically, that's making people drive like maniacs. Though I never heard of anyone throwing a grappling hook out of a vehicle in L.A. traffic. But you'd think they would if they were inspired by Road Wars. In a 1998 article for The Atlantic titled Road Rage Versus Reality, this was a key article that came out in the whole debate over road rage, Michael Fomento debunked a handful of studies and polls that were really supporting the notion of road rage at the time. And he argued that road rage was just an excessively broad term that was applied to a variety of violent situations, and that it was ultimately detrimental because it also allowed us to ignore actual behaviors and actual situations that were causing accidents, such as one example that he brings up is people running red lights.
Mm-hmm.
That's a dangerous scenario that can result in crashes and fatalities. But it's also a problem that has been successfully treated with stoplight cameras in many areas. But that's not nearly as sensational a concept as the bestial nature of the human rising up in your little car out there on the highway. It doesn't sell papers.
No, it doesn't, right? The human barbarian in tattered clothing speeding toward you. The reality of it is that when road rage does happen, or even aggressive driving, when it does happen, it happens in some really, like, boring gridlock traffic scenarios. Mm-hmm. When someone has been marinating in, say, like a two-hour-long traffic gridlock situation, that's when you see tempers flare.
Yeah, and I do want to mention, there's not a single traffic jam scene in Road Warrior. It's all constant motion. There's no bumper-to-bumper traffic in that film.
Yeah, because if it were, that would be an entirely different movie, right?
Yeah.
Like the sort of post-apocalyptic circumstances would not have occurred.
Yeah, though I would like to see a post-apocalyptic traffic jam film. That would be good.
Huh, all right. Someone's working on it. All right. So we're going to talk about the territorial markings that we make with our cars, and what we do to our cars, and what that says about us when we have, say, a bumper sticker.
Indeed, you do see the bumper sticker scenario out on the road is rather interesting, because you see the cars without, completely, just completely devoid of stickers, and you have the ones with the sprinkling, and then there are the ones where every political or social or music-related interest that I have will be represented on the rear of my vehicle.
Yeah, and I just want to mention this in passing. One of the strangest personalized license plates I've ever seen was on like a RX-7, you know, kind of a sporty car, driven by a guy, and it said "Whackin' It."
Whackin' It?
Whackin' It.
Like whack-a-mole?
I will leave the interpretation up to you guys.
Maybe he was the inventor of whack-a-mole, and that's how he made his fortune and purchased said automobile.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But the fact that he had a personalized license plate tells us a little bit something about him. And the reason we know this is because we were looking at a 2008 Colorado State University study by social psychologist William Zlemko, who wanted to see if drivers of cars with these kind of adornment, right, bumper stickers, window decals, personalized license plates, and other sort of territorial markers, if they not only get mad when someone cuts in their lane or is slow to respond to a changed traffic light, if these people are more likely than those who do not personalize their cars to use their vehicles to express aggressive driving behavior. So, again, aggressive driving behavior could be tailgating, honking, you know, just the other random stuff, you know, flicking someone off.
Mm-hmm.
So participants were asked to describe the value and condition of their cars, as well as whether they had personalized them in any way. And the researchers would record, you know, if they had seat covers, bumper stickers, special paint jobs, stereos, or even plastic dashboard toys. And then they asked them a bunch of questions about their driving. And so to keep the participants from realizing what the team was getting at, they put in some, you know, fake questions like, hey, what kind of music do you listen to in the car? Along with questions like, if someone is driving slow in the fast lane, how angry does this make you? And they used a pre-existing scale called use of vehicle to express anger to ferret out those participants who might use aggression while driving. So, of course, people who had a larger number of personalized items on or in their car were 16% more likely to engage in anger-fueled road behavior. That's not huge, but that's significant. And so the other finding they had is that it, when it came to bumper stickers, it didn't matter if you had a bumper sticker that said coexist or world peace, or if you had I love guns. You know, the sentiment didn't matter. Just the fact that you personalized your car mattered.
Now, sadly, it sounds like this study came before putting testicles on your truck became a thing. So I guess we sadly don't see that represented in the data.
Although that would be in that would be under the umbrella of personalizing your car, right? So if you decide to hang a pair of metal testicles on your car, you possibly could be in this category of a higher degree of aggressive car behavior. So the question then becomes, why? Why? If you personalize your car, why might you drive more aggressively? Well, the idea is that people carry around three kinds of territorial spaces in their heads. Okay. One is personal territory, like a home or your bedroom. The second involves space that's temporarily yours, say like an office cubicle or a gym locker.
Okay.
And then the third is a kind of public territory. So park benches, walking trails, and of course, roads. So the idea is that you, the more you personalize your car, the more it's becoming this sort of territory that you're wielding in these different spaces.
Okay. Yeah. And you can see that sort of, transform on the road into a situation of like, my space is this position on the road that with a certain maintained space between vehicles, a certain maintained speed that I get to keep on the road. And if you infringe on any of those, you're infringing on this space.
Exactly. And of course, that doesn't mean that if you have a bumper sticker or something in your dashboard that you're driving around recklessly.
No.
It just, this one study just tells us a little bit of a statistic here. 16% more likely to engage in anger-fueled antics.
Now, of course, another area in which we invest ourselves personally in our automobiles and can get rather possessive comes to parking spaces. And we've all encountered this, right? What you're dropping by the grocery store to pick up some things, right? Or you know, coming in and out of work, the parking lot is busy. You go in, you get what you need to do, you come out. You're going to leave, you're pulling out of your parking place, and there's somebody waiting on the parking place already. And this weird territorial nature kicks in. That doesn't make any sense, right? Because you're done with this place. You're about to go home or go on to the next point on your timeline. But instead, what do? You maybe linger a little bit. Maybe you make some evil eyes at the person that's waiting or even honking for you to move. Well, 1997... study actually looked into this, titled Territorial Defense in Parking Lots, Retaliation Against Waiting Drivers. And they explored just how possessive we get about those parking spaces, demonstrating that drivers are territorial even when it runs completely contrary to the goal of leaving the flipping parking lot. So they conducted three studies here. In the first one, they observed 200 departing cars, and they found that intruded upon drivers took longer to leave a space than non-intruded upon drivers. So, again, somebody's making a visual sign of waiting and being a little grumpy about you taking your time versus somebody that you don't even notice, right? Study 2 involved 240 drivers with a manipulated level of intrusion and status of intruding car, meaning is it a clunker that's waiting on you to leave or is it, you know, somebody in a fancy sports car?
Mm-hmm.
And they found that drivers took longer to leave when another car was present and when the intruder honked. So the honk is the kiss of death.
Yeah.
If you really want them to give up that parking space in short order. They also found that males left significantly sooner when intruded upon by a higher rather than lower status car, but females' departure time didn't differ as a function of the status of the car. So to the males, it mattered. Oh, this is a big important sports car waiting on me. I better move. But the females in this study didn't care. And finally, they simply polled individuals at a mall and asked what would they do if they were pulling out and somebody honked at them. And they found that the vast majority of them said that they would take longer to leave if the driver of the car honked.
I have to say the honking is sort of terrible. And I've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
I had to ask myself, like, have I kind of waited around in my parking space before pulling out because someone was really impatient and did that. And yes, because I think of myself as an efficient egresser and enterer of the car and that this is something that I'm not usually, you know, hanging out in my car and doing stuff.
Yeah.
So it feels, you know, when someone does that, like terribly impatient. And I remember once that I got in my car and just sort of unwrapped a piece of Wrigley's gum for a very long time
uh-huh.
before putting the car in reverse. Because you do. It's like you're trying to exact some sort of punishment or justice.
Yeah. See, this is still my space. This space is still mine for as long as I want it, and you will wait your turn, honker.
Yeah, that's right. 10 more seconds of luxuriously unwrapping this gum.
You know, and we have a weird relationship with the honk in America, it seems, because you go to other places, specifically, I guess I'm thinking of Mexico and some parts of Latin America where, like, the honk is a signal to say, hey, I am here. Or it's more about just letting other drivers know that you are present or that some sort of accident situation might happen. But in the States, it seems like to blow the horn is to say, you are out of line. and possibly potentially killing people.
Well, I think it's the duration of the signal. So if it's a quick beep, you know, or a quick honk, it's kind of like, hey, come on, watch out, I'm here.
But to lay on
the
horn.
But to lay on the horn is the problem. And this reminds me, too, of the politeness episode that we just did. And we were talking about communication and directness and how in Russia, the more direct, the better, and how people don't lose face, you know, because they don't have a problem with that sort of negative feedback. But perhaps here in the United States, we're a little bit more sensitive to that, to the honk.
Yeah.
And that may be because we see the car as an extension of ourselves. We've already put out this idea that it could be a sort of territory for us, a third home for us, or a second home of sorts. But there's this idea that it could actually like physically embody us. And that is not a new concept that we have introduced on this podcast before, because we've talked about tool use and how humans, we fold our hands around a tool and all of a sudden becomes part of us. And we have body schema. We have a map in our mind of where we are in space and time, and we incorporate these objects. And we've even talked about how the mind will sometimes adopt a fake limb, in the right context, of course, usually an experiment, as our own, if prompted, right? So we've got that sort of proprioceptive drift to other objects and people when the context warrants it. So it's not so weird to think that you could do the same thing with your car. Now, there's a 2011 Temple University paper by Ayalia Ruvio, who found that two studies on driving and relationship to car bore out this idea that a car could be an extension of yourself. And as a result, you could have stronger, aggressive driving tendencies. So Ruvio and a colleague used 134 surveys of men and women in Israel, averaging 23.5 years of age, to examine the influence of personality, attitudes, and values on driving. And the researchers also looked at the factors of risk attraction, impulsivity, and driving, I love this, as a hedonistic activity, as well as perceptions about time pressures. And they did this with another 298 people, too. So they had a sort of part B of this study that involved some of the people from the first study. And they saw an uptick in disregard for road rules, aggressive behavior, and the sense that these people were under more pressure in terms of time. So it's worth noting that this study is dealing with an age group that is younger. And as a result, Ruvio and her colleagues posit that some of this has to do, this attachment to car and extension of self through car, with the fact that people haven't really developed their personalities fully yet. Mm-hmm. And so part of this car is informing who they think they are.
Huh.
And the sort of maybe the bleeding edges of themselves out there in a public space.
And this is where we see things like the red car situation, right?
Well, more like the sports cars that you're thinking, like the red sports car.
Yeah,
and
red
like,
sports car.
Yeah, hey, I'm here. I'm going to tear it up on the streets. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sort of Lightning McQueen persona. If you've seen Cars.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I have not seen it, but I know of what you speak.
It's a kid favorite.
Oh.
So, yeah, there's this idea that part of your personality is being performed by the car. But then, of course, you have the risk-taking. And anybody who worked for an insurance company knows what I'm talking about, or anybody who has someone on their policy who's under the age of 25 knows what I'm talking about. You're going to get charged more for youth when youth is driving, because youth doesn't have the fully formed prefrontal cortex that we've talked about before, specifically when we've talked about the teenage brain.
Yeah, they're going to take more risks to fit in. It's to the teenage brain, it's vital to find a place in some sort of social scenario so that they can survive.
Right. In the prefrontal cortex and in the executive function of, hey, is this a good idea? Maybe not be as fully engaged at that age as you would want it to be.
And of course, in America, those teenagers grow up into a culture that has historically loved its automobiles. I mean, the automobile industry continues to be a symbol of American ingenuity and accomplishment and
freedom.
Yeah, I mean, it's as well as other vehicles such as the motorcycle, right? The freedom to be out there and own the road. But are times a-changing? They might be, according to a Pew Research Center study from 2010 published as Americans in Their Cars, Is the Romance on the Skids? And they looked at the trends in terms of loving your car versus just seeing your car as this thing you have to be in to go from point A to point B. They found in 2010 that 69% of American drivers said that they liked to drive. They genuinely liked it. And that was down from 79% in 1991. And just 23% said that they considered the car something special compared to 43% in 91. Now, the Pew survey identified a number of different factors that were contributing to these trends. And you might think that gasoline might be a big one, but gas actually only came in at 3%. 3% of people saying that gasoline prices factored in to their falling out of love with cars. The big one was traffic congestion, 23% of those surveyed. Another big factor, other drivers, 14%. So already we see, 37% tied to traffic congestion and having to put up with other people in the cars that make up that congestion. Commuting adds another 10% on top of that. And then running errands also contributed 10%. And again, this is all pointing back to that idea that there's just more and more cars out there, more people driving on these roads that that just can't keep up with the increase in population. A National Household Travel Survey in 2001 found that at that point, for the first time since studies had been conducted, there were more personal vehicles on the road, 204 million, than licensed drivers, 191 million in the country. It's still noted that in that Pew survey, 69% of Americans, I mean, that's still two-third margin of Americans who love driving. And we still spend a lot of time in our car. We sing in there, we listen to music, we listen to podcasts, we talk on the phone, we read, we groom, we sleep. But we seem to do a lot of things that are about making do with our time in the car, or even sort of transcending that time we have to spend in the car versus just really loving the road.
Yeah, and I think you're touching on something here with technology becoming so much more a part of our lives and informing our lives that we begin to look for these bits of stolen time, right? Mm-hmm. Where we can listen to a podcast or listen to music or access 1 million other things that we can via the internet. And so this idea that Tesla co-founder and CEO Elon Musk has is really interesting. He thinks that computers will do a much better job than us when it comes to driving, to the point where statistically humans would be a liability on the roadways and would be banned from driving in the future sometime.
Yeah. I mean, he makes a comparison to elevators, right? In the old days, you got in an elevator, there was an elevator operator to make this piece of machinery go up and down. But it got to the point where we didn't need the operator anymore. The technology was such that the elevators took care of everything. And if you had an operator, it would hinder the process.
Right. And so you've got these two different things going on. You have computers rising to the occasion to do this in a way that is manageable, right? Not cost effective now, but perhaps in the future. And then you have us consuming so much media and trying to find spare moments in our lives that we're pretty open to trying out something like this, if it means that on our commute we could read a book on a device, as opposed to sit there in, you know, knuckle whitening traffic, trying not to yell at someone or get angry about something.
Indeed. And ultimately, computers would be able to just manage the flow of traffic more efficiently. In this scenario, you wouldn't have to worry about all the little things like rubbernecking and tailgating. Everything could be, there could be a standard distance between cars. A standard speed could be maintained. And yeah, to your point, you could just lean back, read a book, and not worry about all those little things on the road.
Yeah, sounds lovely. And according to the Boston Consulting Group, fully automated driverless cars could make up nearly 10% of global vehicle sales, or about 12 million cars a year, by the year 2035. So it's something that could happen, you know, over the next couple of decades here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been developing the technology for some time, so it's really not a matter of if, but when.
Yeah, and also a matter of, like, well, how are we going to muck that up as humans, you know? Like, how are we going to express our status in these driverless cars? Or maybe even just having a driverless car at that point becomes a status object.
And what will Whackenit think of it, right? Will he appreciate having this free time in the vehicle, or is he going to miss command of his vehicle on the open road?
And what will he be doing in his vehicle?
We don't know. Just no way to know.
Nope.
All right, so there you have it. Road rage, aggressive driving, something I think we can all relate to on one level or another. If you want to check out more topics related to human behavior, automobiles, what have you, go on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, videos, blog posts, links out to social media accounts, you name it.
And you have ideas about this? You want to share the traffic infraction that drives you the most crazy? Well, you can do that by sending us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.